Clearly, the task before us is daunting, and certainly, in two sets of 14 30-minute lectures, we will begin only to scratch the surface of an enormous set of problematica, both new and old. I want to apply a few rules before we begin. First, I firmly believe that the history of espionage is best studied as international history. That is, we scholars are called upon in the post-Cold War era to step well outside of traditional, narrow, national perspectives, traditional myopias, and we are expected to draw from sources in national security archives of all players, and to critically challenge any one nation's versions of events. Decentering and internationalizing are the operative principles here. The goal is to write international history on the basis of solid social science methods drawing on a huge array of newly released sources. Unfortunately, as soon as we exercise the practice of decentering, we find ourselves ready to dispense with so much of the existing literature on the history of espionage. Once we reach World War I, the reliability of the materials and the confidence of our conclusions will decline rapidly, and therefore we must vigorously avoid viewing history as ideology, and that means reminding ourselves that the history of the shadow world is by definition a contested space. Why a world history of espionage? Because if human history is defined in part by the movement from local and distinct to international, global, and interconnected, then espionage is an intrinsic part of this process of the history of globalization. To a large degree, there was no institutional history of espionage until England emerged as the supreme and dominant world power in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, some 450 years ago. With the emergence of modern nation-states in early modern Europe, so too did espionage become an intrinsic part of governing, so that this first part of the series will investigate the use of espionage among the ancients through the late Middle Ages. But the turning point will come in the Age of Discovery and the extension of European powers from old Europe to the New World. Part one of this course will end at the height of the colonial era, at the dawn of the 20th century, just prior to World War I. This begs an obvious question. If espionage and spying became commonplace by the 17th century, if the first modern spy master was Sir Francis Walsingham under Queen Elizabeth I, way back in 1572, why do we persist in seeing espionage as a modern 20th century phenomenon? The answer lies in the point I am trying to make, that too often we use history as an ideological weapon. In this context, historical writing about the 20th century has tended to lay blame on Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union as the espionage aggressors and Western powers as innocent victims. Can any historically informed person really accept such assertions? By the 20th century, espionage was so critical to modern systems of government that virtually everyone was spying on virtually everyone else, friends and foes alike. And this is where we begin to run into serious trouble. As we move into the 20th century, we move from history to contemporary history, where accepted knowledge about past events has managed to root itself in the collective memories of all sides, both East and West, North and South, developed and lesser developed, capitalistic, communistic, socialistic, fascist, and everything in between. There is no better account of the shifting sands of what we knew or claimed to know than E.P. Thompson's own study of the tragic fate of his brother Frank, a pro-communist British Special Operations Executive officer killed in Bulgaria in 1944. A good deal of contemporary history rests upon the information of people who know. The problem is not that they know nothing, but that they do, in fact, know a great deal. But what they know can pass over the years by a process of selection into an ideological code which presents, in the form of anecdote or fact, what they wish to be believed. If, at the same time, harder evidential material is suppressed or destroyed, the truth of a past event may become irrecoverable. Inevitably, not just the collection of facts, but the writing of history, and even the way we ask questions, becomes tantamount to an act of provocation. Again, E.P. Thompson's experience as evocative questioner is instructive. These questions remained and remain sensitive. Certain questions clearly provoked discomfort many years after the events, and these sensitivities increased rather than diminished over the years. As the Cold War developed, it required on both sides a continual reprocessing of approved views of the past or amnesia about the past and the accretion of new dimensions of myth.